So the exam is going to be next class, and it's going to be, some of you asked me, I thought it's obvious, but everything that's covered by the second homework is going to be included. So which is the last class, the September 28th class, up to end of September 28th class. That's the stuff that you're responsible for. Anything I haven't yet asked on the homework is not on the exam. So the classification, text classification and content-based filtering is not included. Okay. Let's see what's going on with this guy. Are there any questions while I play with this computer thing? Every day it's a different problem. I know what happened to this guy. Yes. You mean the linear discriminant analysis? Is there a particular reason for that? I don't know. I mean, I think I haven't seen that many papers that used LDA. There are. I mean, I think LDA is probably more used than decision trees for text classification, because decision trees, as I mentioned in the class, the beginning class, they're much better when a very small subset of the features winds up determining the class. And they're not as good for scenarios such as text, where a large number of features sort of add a little bit to make you a member of a class. Okay? It was more of the most papers that I have seen in text classification tend to use NBC and methods based on NBC, the co-training and the boosting. Basically, co-training is something that's used a lot, and the EM version also, which is allowing NBC to work on unlabeled examples. That also is used a lot. Other questions? Yes. Speak loud. I can't hear what you said. No. So the idea is you have a bunch of unlabeled examples, right? Apart from the labeled examples, and what you did was you trained yourself just on the labeled examples upfront. So you got an NBC classifier, okay? Now you applied it to the unlabeled examples. So in the case of, so if you are talking about content-based filtering, you have bought some books or you have registered your displeasure with some books. So those are the ones for which the labels are available. The rest of the Amazon database is unlabeled as far as you're concerned, because you never said anything about those books. So what you're doing, what the learner is doing, is it's taking the classifier that it learned from the few preferences you have expressed and applying that classifier to classify unlabeled instances. Okay? Now, when it did that, the simplest idea, which actually doesn't work as well, is suppose it just applied and directly classified all the unlabeled to yes, no. Because after all, you know, NBC will tell you for each class what's the probability that this particular new example belongs to that class. And then you take the maximum class and say that is your class. Okay. Now, if you did this, now you suddenly have more training examples. Okay. And so you can retrain the NBC classifier. Okay. Because the way the NBC classifier works is it starts with the training examples and it is computing its parameters, which are these class probabilities and the training attribute given class probabilities based on the training examples. Now you have more training examples. Yeah, so you can keep doing this. So the idea is that the NBC parameters will keep changing and until you reach a plateau where you're no longer improving training accuracy. Okay, so as you do this, the question is when do you stop, and you can keep testing it with respect to some piece of the test data. And when you are no longer improving accuracy, then you can stop at that point. Okay, and as I said, the version that actually works is the one where you you actually give fractional classes. So you actually use the class posterior probability. So rather than for the unlabeled instances, rather than say it belongs to the maximal probability class, you say you belong to 0.7. I mean, you belong to class 7 with 0.7 probability, class 1 with 0.7 probability, class 2 with 0.3 probability. And then you use those fractional numbers in computing the actual probability. Okay? And I think there was this nice paper that I mentioned after the class. I mean, there's a as to if you can do both. You can do, if you can do both co-training and EM, which is likely to be better. And in a sense, actually, they say, they point out in that little paper that, you know, they actually found that co-training works better. And it's probably not surprising because EM essentially does not take into account class information at all. What we are doing, this business of self-bootstrapping, is expectation maximization. And it's more of an unsupervised approach, which is, it's not actually sensitive to classes, okay? Whereas the co-training essentially takes class information into account. Okay, so if you remember, the co-training is the one where you have a large feature vector, you took two pieces such that they are potentially independent of each other given the class. And then you learned two different learners. Okay, you learn two different learners, and then each learner then is used to classify the unlabeled example for the other learner, and they keep doing this, and that is basically pairwise bootstrapping as again as self bootstrapping, okay, and that works even better. And in general, these are not just a couple of isolated examples. The idea of iteratively applying a learning algorithm to itself on variations of data is something that's is quite a bit entrenched in the. It's actually on, but it doesn't want to show me anything. Oh, it's coming now. Okay, good. Let's see. It's quite a bit entrenched. So here is an interesting idea. In fact, the mother of all ideas of this type is called the boosting, which I did not discuss in the class. But let me give you just a little background, an intuitive idea of how boosting works. So boosting would work if you have a set of learners. Learner 1, learner 2, learner 3, etc. Okay. Here is a way you could train them such that all of them together work better in training the data on classifying the data than any one of them individually. So the idea is the following. You apply the first learner to the set of data points that you have, the training data that you have. Okay. And then having classified it, I mean having trained it, okay, then you apply your learner to your training data. Now, even if you train on the data, you don't necessarily have to completely fit it. You know, most of the time what happens is having trained on this data, you might still misclassify some of the training examples. Okay? The training examples that you are misclassifying will then somehow become more important. Those are the ones the first learner did not learn well enough. So you ask the second learner to concentrate on them. And the third learner will concentrate on the examples that the first two did not do well on. Okay? And in general, there is a way to do this. There is a way to do this in such a way that such a way that with the same training data, you're basically picking from the training data. Let's say, suppose you have 10,000 samples, okay? So for the first learner, each learner you might want to give, let's say, 5,000 samples to train it, or maybe 10,000 samples to train it. So you have these 10,000 samples sitting in a bucket, okay? Now each of them have 1 over 10,000 probability of being picked in the beginning. So for the first learner, what you do is you pick with replacement 10,000 samples from this bucket. Okay, you're picking it. So it's possible that some of the things are picked more than once. But since all the probabilities are 1 over 10,000, you're likely to pick pretty much all of them once. That's the first learner. And you train it on the 10,000 samples. Then you apply it back to these 10,000 samples and see which are the ones it's not capturing correctly, which are the ones it's not classifying correctly. Okay, the ones it's not classifying correctly, you increase their probability a little more. So the next time around, they're not going to be 1 over 10,000, they may be 5 over 10,000. And so when you increase the probability of these guys, just so that the entire probability adds up to 1, the other guy's probability reduces. So the problems on which you're doing well, you don't need to work on them. The problems that you're failing, you want to spend more time reading more on them. That's essentially what boosting is doing. Okay, so they change this probability distribution, then they pick the new 10,000 samples. Now when you pick new 10,000 samples again from replacement, you're more likely to pick the failing one, the ones that were failing for the previous ones more often. And you give this to your second learner. And you do this, you keep doing this. And in fact, the first and second and third learners can essentially be the same learner. In the sense, it could be the same NBC learner. But it's capturing, the first one is capturing the entire data. The second one is capturing, in essence, the ones that are misclassified by the first data and so on. Okay, so you can almost imagine if it is the case, let's say that there are pluses and minuses. So class one and class two are flowing into each other such that there is no single line separating them. So you, in the first learner, you will wind up putting the best line that you can, because of which some of the training data is actually misclassified. And that sort of becomes, more of an input to the second learner. Okay? And that's called boosting. And it turns out that actually it's boosting, many of these methods are connected in some ways to boosting approach. And so co-training, for example, which is basically learning to improve a learner based on, you're taking the same training data, but you're doing better than just a single learner. This idea is not isolated. It comes from bagging, boosting sorts of ideas. Yes?
How exactly, do you take a majority voting of all the learners for a particular
state? This is again the ensemble learning issue. So when you have multiple learners, what should you do if you did actually learn multiple learners, how would you figure out the classification for a new example when you have 15 learners, okay, 15 experts trying to tell you what is a new example, right? You do all the possible things that you can do. The simplest one would be majority, okay? Take the majority vote. The second would be weighted. So each learner is given a weight. So some experts count for more than others. A third one could be that you actually would basically have a hierarchical model where you use, the first two that I talked about, all learners are being called on. Okay, a better idea would be when we are actually going to get our diseases diagnosed, first we go to the neighborhood doctor, and if that guy is pretty sure that you're not about to die, then he would not send you to the next specialist. If he is iffy, then he would send you to the next specialist. If that guy is somewhat iffy, he will send you further. Okay, you could do this too. And the reason they do it that way, rather than all the doctors vote on whether or not you're going to die, that's a much better idea, except the insurance companies won't be too happy. Okay, the voting approach basically makes all the doctors vote on your disease, whereas a hierarchical approach would make, like, the cheap learners will vote first, but they not only vote, they give a confidence interval. So if it's an NBC classifier, let's say, okay, can you convert, if an NBC classifier says, yeah, this particular example belongs to class two, can I associate some notion of confidence to it? Oftentimes I can, because what is the actual entire posterior distribution. If it is the case that there are two classes and class 2 had probability 0.500001 and class 1 had probability 0.49999, then really the confidence is pretty iffy. It's too close. Okay. In such cases, when there is low confidence in your judgment, then you call the second learner, then you call the third learner. So there will be only a logarithmic number of learners would be called. That's the third approach. A fourth approach would be learn the weights that you should be using for the training population that you have. So the idea is, based on the example, the weights given to each learner are dependent on the example itself. Okay, when a new example comes, all the learners judge the example, and then the weights also are given based on the example. And so those are then multiplied with the votes. All of these are tried. The simplest boosting just uses weighting. Okay. Other questions? Yes. Bagging to boosting, the only difference is, in the case of bagging, you're just taking a random set of samples every time without biasing it. So if you, the idea of bagging is very closely related to boosting, but much less interesting. What you're doing is, you have 10,000 samples like before, you have 10 learners. For each learner, you'll give a new random sample. Okay? And they're all given a new random sample from the same 10,000 samples. That's out. But it's not being done to improve. In the case of bagging, there is no deliberate attempt to make a second learner improve on the first learner's mistakes. Okay, it's just essentially trying to have multiple learners not being trained on the exact same data, but hopefully slightly different samples. Okay, but these are all meta techniques. If you have a bunch of learners, then you can do bagging, then you can do boosting, then you can do co-training, then you can do EM to do more than what you can just do with a single learner. Okay? And of course, there is a penalty you are paying. You are paying more training, of course. And also, depending on the way you are using multiple experts, you might also be doing more testing. At the time of testing, actually, you'll wind up calling a lot of learners. Okay? Okay. Okay. Just sign this sheet up. I want to take an idea of who is actually showing up. Write your name and sign. Okay. So, what are there any questions related to the exam stuff itself? Anything? Yes. If I think it's reasonable enough to do it, then yes. I mean, the sense, if I make you do it, it might be probably because there's an obvious, easy way to do. You should almost be able to see what the eigenvalues, eigenvectors are. Okay. So the in-class portion of it, my interest is not to make you number crunch, but to make sure that you understand when to do what. MATLAB, unless everybody gets to use it, no. So in class, MATLAB makes no sense. And I think I might very well say no calculators even, in which case there are no calculators. Okay. Okay. Other questions? Yes?
Are there questions from the papers? Or, is the question going to be the same as the homework question?
No, they're not going to be the same as the homework questions. They're going to be drawn from, this is again from the learning issue, okay? What is a fair test? The fair test is one where the testing samples are drawn from the same distribution as the training samples. That's all, okay? A very simplistic learning algorithm is testing samples are the same as the training samples. Makes no sense. In which case, you may as well just table lookup. A fair test in machine learning terms is the the testing samples are drawn from with the same distribution as the training samples. And the training samples here are the class lectures, the homeworks, the specimen exams, etc. Okay. Other questions? Okay. I don't know why this thing, every time there's something new. Oh, good. Okay, at least good. Okay, so what I am, so those are all the things that we already discussed. So what I'm going to do is sort of getting to the third part of the semester. So in the beginning I said we have, all we do in this course can be thought of as revamping three different disciplines in the context of text data. I said we'll do some of our text retrieval and do it in the case of web, and data mining, machine learning, and do it in the case of web, and databases and do it in the case of web. Okay. So presumably you would not yell at me if I say that we have done that and that, although we'll continue doing more of these, but we have done retrieval. You know now what is IR and how is IR different in, I mean, how does it become different in the context of web search, for example. And you also know what are some of the learning clustering, et cetera, techniques, mining techniques, and how are they used, and which of them are more useful, how are they used, when are they used in the context of web-based search and so on. Some examples, okay. Now, basically, that leaves us with this database stuff. So in a sense, I'm going to be looking at that for the rest of the semester. Not just in databases, but when the third thing is learned, now we can start putting together problems which have aspects of retrieval, mining, and databases, which I couldn't have done in the beginning of the semester. So that's also something that we'll do. Okay. So first let me just start. So today's class really is sort of about a very quick review of databases, but mostly from the point of view of what parts of databases do we care about with respect to the aims of this course, and why do we care about them. Okay, that's basically what we're going to do. And from what I remember, most of you have done database courses, have database knowledge, right? Okay, so there is actually this set of slides, there are about 67 slides. I hid most of them except 26, which are the only ones that I'll show here, if I do at least that. If you have some other questions on database basics, you can always look at the rest of the slides. Okay, so let me just start with why do I even care about databases? Three different reasons at least I can mention, okay. The three reasons that I want to mention are, deep web is all databases. In fact, web is made not just of pages, but really of pages generated by back-end databases. Okay, there are very few sites which are just pages directly. Most of the sites really are back-end database server that is generating a web page. So if you're a program, and the pages are generated so that people can read it. So if you're a program, you're much better off just trying to access the database directly. Okay, and so that's one reason why you are interested in databases from the context of web, from the context of this course. The second, of course, which I have sort of talked a lot about in the beginning of the semester, is if you have structured data, you can do a lot more with it. Okay, text is okay, but if you have structured data, you can do a lot more with it. And some of the simplest types of structured data that has been handled in the world has been handled by databases. Okay, and so it would be nice to see what databases do to handle structured data, and also how do we convert non-structured data into structured data. And the third thing, of course, is since web databases are on the web, that's what I said in the beginning itself, and I assume you agree, databases themselves change. Okay, in fact, the kinds of problems that are important from the point of view of a database research, database researcher, are very different before and after web. Okay, what I'll do is sort of spend a little bit more time on each of these three, and this is sort of can be thought of as an overview of what aspects of what sorts of problems we'll be talking about for the rest of the semester too. Okay, and then after those three are over, for the rest of the today's class, I'll just be talking about some of the traditional database work and, you know, how it's connected. Okay, so deep web is databases. The crawlable web pages are just the tip of the iceberg, really. And upfront, it's not obvious to you that it's tip. It may well be that you're thinking it's an inverted pyramid with most of the pages are crawlable and a few pages are generated on demand by databases. And according to studies, actually, that's been done, in fact, it may be complete opposite. In fact, the amount of data that's generated by backend databases that's available out there, you know, if you just count the software engineering metrics of number of pages, number of lines per page, et cetera, even if you do that, there are like two orders of magnitude more web that doesn't meet the eye than the web that meets the eye to your crawler. Okay. Now, when Google crawls the world, it only captures the pages. I mean, in general, it only captures the pages that actually have a sort of a static URL. How does it capture the pages that correspond to, the pages that would be generated by the backend database with respect to a query? So the query, if you send it to the database, it will then send the answers, which are then converted into a web page and displayed to you for that second. And then after you leave, that page disappears. Okay, that part of the web is not crawled at all, actually. Right now it's not. In fact, there are some exceptions. I mean, Google does do a couple of things. So for example, SiteSeer really is run by a backend database. Okay, and yet, if you're looking for a paper, oftentimes you find that you can always get the SiteSeer page for that paper. DBLP, which is a bibliography server, is run by a backend database. However, if you say my name and DBLP, you will get the page listing exactly the various publications with my name in it. Okay, so some of that is done, but overall it's not done really. In fact, that entire web is out of bounds right now for what search engines are doing. Okay, yes. In the cases where it works, it works for a variety of reasons. Right now, it all works on ad hoc means. You know, either sometimes search engines can provide, I mean, the database, like DBLP, for example, can provide, certain standardized interfaces for the Google crawler. Okay, in fact, I think SiteSeer does that, okay, because SiteSeer is interested in being known. And because it's interested in being known, it will make sure that Google crawls, okay? Just as you are interested in being known, a lot of people are not interested in being known. The data, you know, for example, SiteSeer pages are, you know, almost crawled, okay? And you even have caches of them by Google. But do you have such caches for Sabre fares, plane fares, flight fares? No, okay? Because those are things that are only run after you give a query to somebody who has the ability to access every database, either like one of your travel search engines. Okay? So these many things exist which are like deep-end databases, but you know, some obvious ones that you know of are airline fare databases, newspaper classifieds. You know, every newspaper has a classified section, right? Every newspaper has an employment section. Okay, how can I provide, you know, an easy way to search all the employment opportunities? Well, monsterjobs.com sorts of guys try to do these kinds of things. Okay, but there are no general solutions for those. For example, a company called Transformic, which as of 2 months back was trying to do a subsidiary called everyclassifieds.com, which essentially has classified advertisements from 5,000 different news sources, okay, in one place. What do you think happened? If you go and check transformic.com, you will see, let me see what happens. Um, There. Disappeared. Okay. Everyclassifieds.com disappeared. The guy who did this is this guy, Alan Halevy. And if you go check his current schedule, let's see, where is he? Google ate him up. Okay? Basically, they just hired him. They bought his company. We just started in 2004, and Google bought him. Okay? And if Google buys people, they'll go. Basically, they bought his company. Which is another way of saying that everybody is aware of how important deep web is. So, in fact, I have this, this is as old as like 1 month. It's probably last couple of weeks this thing happened. So, even if you actually act as if you're trying to solve the problem, all the big kids are very interested in you because they know it's a big problem. Okay, that's the good thing about big problems. Okay, so that's about the deep web. And so, what do you want to do with deep web? We want to crawl and index the deep web. Okay, and we want to select the right set of databases that might be useful for answering a query. Not just a set of pages, but a set of databases that are most relevant to answer your query. Okay? And then probably send your query to those. Okay? And then basically you want to be able to provide information aggregation integration services so that there are all these databases out there. You would like users to be able to see one single database interface, one single query interface where they provide, they'll put in their queries and everything happens magically behind, and the right databases get called, they'll all be pulled, they'll take their answers and then send you the answers back. That's what search engines are supposed to be doing. They only do it right now for static text pages. Okay? Now, if you want to do this, you're really handling databases and you better know how databases work and what is the differences, similarities, etc. Okay? And so if you want to do these, then there are a bunch of challenges such as wrapper generation. So most databases oftentimes wind up, when they give out stuff, they give it out in some pseudo English and you want to convert it back to tuples, okay, some form of form. So you want to kind of unwrap the wrapped data. This is a humongous thing. In fact, what Transformic does is this, schema mapping, or it actually acts as if it's trying to do schema mapping. If there are 5,000 classified advertisement sources, each of them have an advertisement tuple, right? Each of them is basically a table of advertisements. So each advertisement reads what a bunch of things, such as, you know, what is the employment opportunity, where is it, how much money is there, what are the eligibilities, etc., etc., etc. Now, if you know databases, you know that you need a table for the attributes and the ranges for the attributes, and that's your schema. Is there a standardized schema for classified advertisement? No. Everybody makes their own little schema. They all look almost same, but they are different. Different enough that if you combine, you know, schemas from different sources, then essentially what you're getting is gobbledygook. So you need approaches to kind of map schemas, you know, from disparate heterogeneous schemas into a single schema. So one idea that you could come up with is, I don't care about what the world thinks. I think I'm going to, for myself, standardize. I'm the guy who is providing this general interface for classified advertisements. And I will come up with a particular schema. Okay, and I'll say every classified advertisement requires these 1,500 attributes, these 200 attributes. Okay, and then I just basically give the values for all those attributes and I'll have my advertisement. That's good enough. But now I have to populate this, right? So everybody has their own schema, so I need to at least make a mapping from each of those schemas to my schema. Okay? And if they change their schema without telling you, then you have to maintain the mapping. Okay, so it's quite a labor-intensive thing. And some of the open problems right now are, can you at least semi-automate these sorts of mapping techniques? So that's one of the issues. And then again, wrapper generation, even wrapping, unwrapping can be learned. So you normally, you would wind up finding for each source, when it sends the data, it would be in a particular format, you kind of decode it. Now this decoding requires some little program that you write. Now overnight, some guy there decides to put some extra blanks in some place or change some font size or something in the way your the page is sent to you. So the decoding fails. Okay, it's not a rocket science. You know, rocket science is you just build one rocket, spend 20 years doing it, or maybe 100 years doing it. This is annoying thing where you have gazillions of wrappers which are changing all the time, and the usual way is to hire a bunch of grad students or undergrads, pay them to maintain these wrappers. Okay, and can you do more than that? That's one of the issues. That's a very important thing that what's doing. You need to handle forms. Many of these databases actually only expose themselves in terms of forms, and you need to access these forms automatically, during the crawling phase. How do you do that? And finally, optimization. In fact, in databases, query optimization is a big issue. If you give a query, you're not talking about just answering it, but answering it in your lifetime, doing it as fast as you can. And there are multiple ways of evaluating the query, and some ways wind up being much faster than other ways. And there's a lot of theory for query optimization. The only problem is most of that goes out the window because most of those assumptions no longer hold when you have databases spread all over the web. Okay, so you are interested in figuring out what are the right ways of doing query optimization. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but in essence what happens is oftentimes when you do query optimization, you use the statistics about the databases. And the traditional databases, you have the statistics for your database in front of you because you are the database manager. You have run the statistics on your database yesterday night, and so you have it for today's use. Okay? If there are 5,000 databases out there somewhere, they are not going to keep sending you statistics. They don't even know you exist. You are an annoyance to them. Okay? And so what you need to do is learn without paining them too much. You need to learn their profiles, so that you know how to do query processing on these databases in better than the worst possible way. So query optimization. Okay, so that's one of the things that is a database challenge. And notice that the entire language here is all about databases. Okay, because there are multiple back-end databases sitting on various parts of the web. Okay, the second part, which is equally important, I think. These are kind of connected. I wrote it as three different reasons because I can talk about them separately, but they're all sort of connected. You are thinking from the point of view of search engine that there are not only pages, but also databases all over the place. So that was the previous page. What do we do with that? Now this slide is essentially saying from the point of view of a database guy. So suppose you're a database guy. Previously, you were only allowing access to your database to people, a couple of people, maybe the people who paid for the access and so on, or they have specialized access thing. Okay, so Sabre database, for example, would be accessible only to travel agents previously. Okay, now all of a sudden, you are a database on the web, and you have a database on the web, and you would like to make it accessible, easily accessible to lots of users. Okay, and so from the point of view of a database manager, they now have to deal with unwashed masses. Previously they were dealing with travel agents who have taken a 3-month course on how to do Sabre database access. Okay, and then they can then start accessing it. Now everybody wants to access it, and they don't know anything about SQL, nothing. So you can always say, well, you shall not be given access. Or you can actually try to wonder, try to think of what should I do as a database provider such that it is actually usable by even people who have no idea as to how to query a database. And so what is the common denominator? They know how to use Google. They know how to use a search engine. So they may know how to do keyword search. How can you do keyword search on databases? See, this is like almost putting things on the head. I mean, I made this sound as if structure helps a lot, right? Which is good. But it's also the case that if all your customers have no interest in using SQL and they want to do keyword queries, then you still need to answer those keyword queries. And what does it mean to answer keyword queries given a database? Okay, that's an interesting problem. Okay, these are issues that come up because the user population has changed for databases. Now, what else has changed for the databases? The medium has changed. Previously, for a, you know, you have a single database that's in the back room, and you have a nice, you know, dedicated connection to that back room database manager. Now, databases are on the web. Okay, and the network can come down. Network has peak times and non-peak times. There are all sorts of unreliability thrown in. So, optimization methods that worked with one set of model assumptions don't work any longer. Okay, in particular, much of database work assumes that all you are supposed to give all the answers to the query, and whoever gives all the answers in the lowest time wins. Okay, now on the web, you more or less start saying that whoever gives the first 10 answers fastest wins. So if I have two databases, and database one gives me all the 1,000 results in 2 hours, and at the 2 hour time it gives all the 1,000 results. Until then it doesn't say anything to me. And the database two gives me 10 results in the first 3 seconds and completes all the 1,000 results in 3 days. Okay, so now which is a better database? From the point of view of total response time, it's clear that the first one is better. But in terms of presence on the web, you know, with impatient users looking for instant gratification, you know, giving some semblance of answers is better than asking them to wait for the best answer. Okay, so how do you optimize for top k tuples, the first k tuples, as against all tuples? Okay, if you again, I'm assuming that you know something about databases, and when you optimize queries, you're optimizing for all tuples. So reduce the time taken to give back all the tuples. What we are doing is optimize to get the first few tuples fast. Okay, and then that buys you time. Most people don't even look for the second page. Okay, so this is something that database guys never had to deal with. And so from their point of view, it's a new research problem. And now sigmoids are, for example, full of these sorts of new optimization models and algorithms that can capture those. Okay, so how does one support keyword queries? How does one support this sort of thing? Total response time versus multi-objective. So first tuples faster are give as many tuples and as little a time. You know, so there are two different things. I want as many tuples as I want, as you can give me, but I also want them as soon as you can give me. So those are totally different objectives. If you have multiple objectives, you're doing multi-objective optimization, which wasn't an issue before. Okay. The other thing, of course, is many databases on the web are, you know, there are no guarantees on the correctness or consistency or completeness of these databases on the web because they're put up by even people like you and me. Okay, so I have a couple of tuples, I'll throw them in. Okay, in normal databases, you assume that all tables are full. There is no inconsistent data. There are no null values. Null values are exceptions. Now, you know what null values are, right? That means if you have a table, you know, some of the values for some of the attributes, you don't know what the values are. So in normal databases, null values are an exception. So dirty data is once in a while comes in, but most of the time you have clean data. If you allow random people to set up databases, what do you think is likely to be the case? Dirty data is what you have to deal with. So it's not an exception. Exception becomes the main rule. So how do you handle data that's inconsistent, incomplete, in answering queries? Yes? No, you can also set up. Random people also can set up data. It depends. Why can't I set up a movie database, for example? What stops me from setting up a movie database?
No, I mean, like, but
Okay, I mean, I understand that more people will be accessing, but don't ever depend on the kindness of strangers, right? I mean, you know, because when email systems were designed, we depended on the kindness of strangers. You know, people who have nothing to tell you are not going to send you email. And you must be feeling extremely good now, right about now, because we're getting mail from all sorts of places who have nothing to tell us, and yet they send us mail. Okay, so the point is, the fact that now databases can be made by somebody means they will be made one day. And in fact, even now they are made. And there are ways in which you could do it in such a way that this would be competitively disadvantageous to your competitors. So I would sponsor that work. If I am selling something and somebody else is selling the same sorts of things, then I might set up some pseudo databases, you know, just to basically kill the other one. Okay? Now, so there is this, there's this, and then finally, you know, previously you just assume that, you know, somebody who's dealing with a database calls an SQL query, and then they're just looking for the answer for that query. They knew exactly what they're looking for. But now, the same people who are doing Google are doing databases, right? And we already agreed that they have no clue what they're looking for. They just have a couple of keywords, and they'll get mad at you if you don't give them good answers. Okay, so it's, you know, basically the query keywords are only a loose projection of what the user is really looking for. And we spent our lifetime in information retrieval trying to figure out how to capture this elusive notion of relevance in the user's head. Okay, and the same users are now handling and accessing databases. So do you really think that they will be calling precise queries now that it's databases as against information retrieval engines? No. They're going to say they'll be going to have just as many imprecise queries. So the question is, how do you bring IR-style query processing to databases? IR-style query processing is where all the tuples are not created equal. And you rank them. And you show the tuples that are most likely to be relevant to the user upfront. And you act like a used car salesman. You look at what the user wants, and you try to kind of guess what they might, you know, even though their query says, show me these cars, you are going to show them some other cars too, because you think they might be relevant. Okay, this is essentially what IR, this is how IR works. And, you know, now database guys have to do IR. You know, it looked like in the beginning, IR folks are the ones who didn't know databases, that's why they're doing IR. Okay, and now we're saying, yeah, you know databases, but your customers don't. Okay, and it's hard to manage, you know, tell, you know, have a universal education SQL course for all the customers. And so you dumb down yourself, essentially, and deal with the user who has, imprecise questions. Okay. Now, I'm not making all this up. If you go back to, I'll send you a link. Database community once in a while gets together, I think every 5 years, and tries to decide what are their research directions, what should they be concentrating on. And they're completely aware of it now. You know, there is, in fact, if you look at any of the SIGMOD VLDBs now, half of the papers are still about B-trees and indexes and so on. And the other half of the papers are things like, what do you do with imprecise queries? What do you do with inconsistent data? What do you do with the multi-object optimization? What do you do with keyword queries in databases? Because they've realized that the days of SQL gurus supporting financial data are over. Okay, and in fact, now unwashed masses searching for all sorts of data are in. Okay, so that's another reason why you need to understand databases, because we are neither database people nor IR people. We are people who are interested in this course. We are people who are interested in doing web well, and whatever is needed, we'll do. Okay, search we'll do, and databases we'll do, mining we'll do. Okay, cross-cutting. And then the last one, which is actually the one that I mentioned long back, is databases offer lessons on exploiting structure. Okay, so in some sense, at least this is not as compelling an issue, but it is true that if I do have structure in my pages, you know, even when there are no backend databases, if I only have text pages, I might still want to be able to extract structure from the text pages so that I can do better query processing. So for example, I mentioned this thing. If I want to ask questions such as, give me all the papers citing Rao not written by Rao, to do that, you need to have converted a normal text file, a PDF file of a paper, into the author block, the body block, the references block. And once you have it, then you can say this keyword appears, in the references block, but doesn't appear in the author block. That's when it's a citation to a paper written by me, but not by me. I'm not citing it myself. Okay. Now, the same sort of a thing, there are lots and lots of examples where if you don't extract structure, and you don't do full NLP anyway, because full NLP is out of form, you can't answer useful questions. So we talked about it a lot in the beginning of the semester, and a big issue in web is how do you automatically extract and exploit structure? Okay. Extracting structure typically means converting text data, parts of the text data, into structured data. So, for example, for a SiteSeer paper, I have converted it into three attributes now: the author block, maybe four attributes: author block, abstract block, and the references block, and the body block. Okay, that's better than just saying here is a paper. Now, how do I convert this? How do I do it automatically? There are two ways of doing it. One is I can do it automatically, which is look at the PDF and do a bunch of learning techniques. So I'll show you enough examples where I have labeled, here is the PDF file, here is the author block, here is the abstract block, here is the references block. I gave you labeled examples. You can then learn to classify, learn to basically predict which part of a paper is likely to be the author block, which part of a paper is likely to be the references block, and so on. Okay, you could do it learning way, or you could also say, people, when you are writing papers, I understand that you don't want to write it in first order predicate logic, but at least put some tags, say that begin author and end author, begin title, end title, begin body, end body. And if that is there, then you can use that structure too. Okay, so the issues here, so is either extract, you want to exploit structure, and so the issues here are either extract it automatically or support infrastructure wherein people will provide tags which are then used. Okay. So the challenges for us would be techniques for extracting information, such as the labeling thing that I just told you. So if I show you enough labeled papers with here is the abstract, here is the text, here is the body, here is the references, you should now start guessing. Given a new paper, where is the abstract part, where is the text part, where is the body part, where is the table title part. Okay. The other thing is languages for representing and handling semi-structured data. We were living in these two completely different worlds, one where everything is attributes and their values, which is the database world. The other is everything is full text. Now we are sort of in between, where there are some parts of the page which have structure and some parts which are completely free form. Okay, so how would you handle such semi-structured data well? Okay, and in fact, the whole entire thing about XML comes right there. XML is a language for modeling semi-structured data. It allows you to write tag and some information and another tag and end tag, new tag, information, end tag. Okay, it's an on the wire language for basically looking at, but basically talking about semi-structured data where some pieces of the data have structure. Okay, so now once you have that, you want the languages for representing, and then you want them, once you represent something in XML, can I quickly ask, for example, queries such as, so I could have an XML version of my thesis which says, section begin and section end, subsection begin, subsection end. And so there could be nested sections, subsections, etc. And can I then ask questions such as, give me the first subsection where the keyword anthropomorphic appears in this guy's thesis? That's an XML query. Okay, so question is, how do you write that query? SQL is a name that's already taken, so you use another name. There's a standard called XQuery. We'll talk about it a little bit. which basically allows you to write these kinds of queries. X query by definition has to be a superset of SQL, which is fully structured, and keyword queries, which are for fully unstructured text data. But it also allows semi-structured data, where you can ask questions such as, give me the first subsection where the keyword appears. So it's like using both keywords and structure. Okay, so that's the X query in XML. That's where we'll talk about that. And then finally, this whole semantic web thing, where you are talking about standards for supporting and exploiting semantic tagging. So the question is, if XML, all XML gives you is the ability to write tags. Okay. Now, we just talked in the beginning of the class that if you get 5,000 people to write schemas for classified advertisements, you're likely to get one schema between all of them, or more like 5,001 schemas. You know, more like 5,001 schemas is probably the answer. Okay. And yet we are saying, people are likely to be very disciplined in writing the tags. You know, so you would write a thesis saying thesis section begin, thesis section end. And this guy will write another thing saying T section begin, T section end. Okay. And some other guy will say sec begin, sec end. Now all of these are tags. They are different from each other just the same way the 5,000 schemas. The tags for XML are the schema of XML. The tags for XML are the schema for XML. Just as you can come up with multiple schemas for describing a particular data, and everybody comes up with their own fun one, you have multiple schemas, multiple tags for, you know, writing XML files. And why is it likely that people are actually going to stick to a standard? No, they're not going to stick to a standard. And so, what would you do? You would wind up coming up with what? You could try standardization. So semantic web essentially hopes that you write your schema and say it is a specialization of this schema which is stored in this guy's page, which itself is taken from this and this schema stored in these and these pages. So by inheritance, you sort of now given a schema here, an XML schema here, an XML schema here, by inheritance between those top guys, the mapping between those top guys, you are trying to figure out the mapping between these bottom guys. That's the dream of semantic web. Now, after doing that, then they'll start doing first order logical inferencing on this. I mean, basically, what databases are doing is logical inferences. If you do a join, it's a sort of a simple, simplistic logical inference. Semantic web wants to do more than that. But you can't even do the small join if you don't have attribute names equalized. Okay? But, you know, it's a different dream. You know, here this is a dream where you are hoping that enough number of standards and enough amount of infrastructure will make people behave. And the extraction and the transformic kind of people are saying, you cannot get people to behave. So they'll do whatever they want, and so we'll just learn to get on with life, given that, you know, people are likely to write very differing schemas. Now, you know, we live long enough to know that both of them are plausible alternatives. There are parts of our life where we stick to standards, and parts of our life where we, especially if the standards are flexible enough. And there are parts of our lives where we don't stick to standards and somebody bears the burden. Okay. And so currently, both of these are approaches for handling, providing more structure to the data. Okay, so actually I think I spent a lot more time than I expected on just giving the reasons why we are interested in databases. But on the other hand, potentially that's really what I want you to understand about databases before we go into specifics. So I think the very first class after this, after the exam, I'm likely to talk about semi-structured data and XML. And you can at least know where it's coming from. And at some point of time, I'll talk about integrating multiple databases. You know why it's coming there. Okay. Now, let me show you maybe a couple of small things about the databases that are of potential interest to us. Well, I mean, the database background that's of potential interest to us. Mostly because we still have 5 more minutes, and Okay. Yes, sir. There are, yeah, so in fact there are lots and lots of different data models that have been looked at in the database research before web. Specific to the web XML data model, which is basically this semi-structured data model, which is close to a sort of object relational data model. Okay, that's one thing. So anyway, given that I already assumed that you know enough about databases, I'm just going to flip through this and stop at slides which seem interesting to me and talk, okay? And so that's the database. You know, a database is supposed to provide query processing capabilities, view management capabilities, storage management also. And then this is just 412 databases. I'm just going to repeat that, you know, in the couple of slides I might actually repeat. And then, you know, it takes some SQL query and it gives an answer back. And most databases out there pretty much are relational databases, where relations are, where the data is stored as basically relations. And you do, and when you start with an application for a data, you know, that you want to put into a database, what you do, of course, is you do, what is it that you want to represent? So this is the requirement modeling. And then you design the schema. These two things happen in your head. Your head is different from my head. So when you do these two, you will come up with a schema that's different from the schema I would come up with. Okay? And then on top of it, we write application programs which probably, you know, access the data. And so these are all the, this is your usual entity relationship model. Even this, it's a nice picture that you wrote to help yourself in writing the schema. The picture I'll write would have a different structure. This is a problem because schemas, you know, are different based on who comes up with it. This is a nice thing to know, which is kind of useful for us, which is one of the nice things about databases are that essentially are designed such that there is a certain level of abstraction. Different levels of database details are shielded from people above that level. Well, that's usual abstraction in everything, right? And networks have 7 layers and databases have 3 layers right now, okay? So you have the actual B tree sit here. There's a physical schema which tells you how the things are stored. On top of it, there's a conceptual schema which basically tells you what tables are there. And on top of that, you would have views, which basically, you know, just because there's a database, not everybody gets to look at the entire database. Amazon has a database of books, right? They have the same exact database that they use and that they allow you to use too, right? But they don't let you see everything. For example, they don't let you see how many copies of the book they have sold recently. They might use that and show which are the best sellers these days, but they will never let you show, let you know how many copies of a particular book have been sold recently. They have that, it's in the exact same database. The way they restrict access normally is by exporting a view, which is in a sense, you can think of a view as a query on the database. Okay, a subset, potentially particular projections of particular tables that you get to access. Okay, and so different users might get to have different views of this database. The nice thing about views is that they're shielding the actual full data from every user. Okay, and if I change the conceptual schema, all I need to make sure is that the view mapping is preserved and the other guy doesn't need to know what I changed. Okay, oftentimes on the web, when this database is on the web, the views are accessed by the users in what way? Forms, XML, the HTTP forms. You fill a form. And if the form doesn't have a little thing saying how many copies have you sold, you don't get to ask that question. Okay, that's one way they can ensure that you only have access to parts of the database. Okay. Okay, that's basically your independence issues, logical data independence as well as physical data independence. Now, you know, this is basically your tables. Okay, one nice thing is in normal databases, you assume that tables are fully filled. And if there is a missing value, that's called a null value. And you could have multiple missing values in dirty data. Furthermore, even when you have clean data, sometimes this table view is actually restrictive. Suppose I want to write a schema for representing a book. Okay? How many author fields am I supposed to have? Yeah, but if you are writing a table in a normal relational database, either you get to say authors, okay, and write the list of authors, or you get to say author 1, author 2, author 3, then every guy must have exactly 3, no more, no less authors. Books normally have one or more authors. How do I do this? The way you normally have to do it is either just make it into a list, or say there is one schema for books that have a single author, one schema for books which have two authors, one schema for books that have three authors. And real books are union of these three schemas. And one of the things we'll see is out of the box, when you start tagging data using XML sorts of standards, you get to all you need to do is author begin, author name, author end. Author begin, author name, author end. Author begin, author name, author end. So the more author tags are there, the more authors are there. So in essence, the schema allows you to say any number of authors. So XML schema is actually more expressive than a relational database schema. It can allow disjunction, for example. It can allow union of, you know, schemas together. Okay. And the other thing, as I said, is this null values is something that is not normally handled that much, but you have to handle. And then you have querying the database. You use SQL. I assume you know much more than this kind of SQL queries. And then you let the query processor figure out actually how to answer this query. So when you ask a query in a form, in essence, what happens to you is that form will get translated into an SQL query to the backend database. That's ultimately what happens. Okay. The last thing that I want to say is about views, if I can get to it. A view, as I said, is essentially, you could think of a view as a, you know, if you want a metaphor, it's a, you know, window into the database. And you, the best way to think of views are to say that a view is the subset of the database that is returned by a particular query. So to define a view, you actually define a query and say whatever is returned from the database by this query is the view that you have access to. And now you can use this view in your queries. Okay, so for example, so this is a create view telephony purchases, which is taking from an underlying database an SQL query, which is product, buyer, seller, store tables. It's using all those, product, buyer, seller, store attributes from two tables, purchase table and product table. And since it's doing where this equal to this, it's actually doing a join. So what it's doing is it's only giving you the piece of the entire database which winds up being the answer to this query. And this is the only part that you have access to. And you can use this in your SQL queries and select from it. You can project it, etc., etc. But if it's not in this view, you don't have access to it. So thinking of views, the easiest way to think of views is as views or queries, predefined queries. Now here is the neat question. I mean, so the most useful thing about views that in databases is to separate access. You know, for different users, you give different views. So you get to have this, and the manager guy might have a different view which involves more of the data, including how much profit did we make on these particular telephone purchases. Okay. There are two views, two types of views that I want you to understand before we leave. Okay. All views are a query. The question is it a virtual view or a materialized view? A virtual view is a query that just sits as a query. And when you were to use this query name in your SQL query, then at that time, during the query evaluation, you inline, you expand that table into an extra query. And the entire thing gets worked on the database. So a virtual view is a macro, a C macro, really. Okay? Now, a materialized view, on the other hand, is you have run this query and stored the answers in a separate database. If nothing changes, from the user's point of view, it doesn't make a difference whether they were accessing a virtual queue or a materialized queue. If things do change, if the database keeps expanding, etc., then there's big difference between virtual and materialized views. Because if the database keeps changing, then you better use virtual views, because what you materialized yesterday is no longer useful today. At the same time, if the database is not changing, or it only changes every Sunday midnight, during the week, you know, going and painting a centralized data server somewhere is much less efficient than, you know, Monday morning you materialize your view, put it in your local machine. And then for the week, you just answer queries directly on that materialized view. Okay? And this is a simple enough difference. People understand this in databases. We will see that these actually wind up playing important parts in deciding, for example, how you would integrate multiple databases. Okay? So for example, if I have a bunch of book-selling databases on the web, and I'm trying to write a single book-selling mediator, everybody comes to me, gives queries to my mediator, and then the mediator then accesses all these other databases. I have the issue of the mediator schema, which is my, you know, the one that I defined, and how does it relate to the schemas of the various other databases that are out there. Okay? I can either say that the mediator is a virtual schema defined in terms of all these databases. It's an actual union of all those databases. So this is like outsourcing. So I wait until the query comes, and then at that point of time, I convert the query into individual queries for all the databases. Okay, that's a virtual view. Or I can also say that really the mediator database corresponds to the entire database schema, and everybody out there are pieces of the schema that have been materialized. So here is one source which is a materialized view on this schema. Here's another source, here's another source. And it turns out those two ways of defining wind up having completely different utilities. Okay, it turns out, for example, that in the second way, if you get yet another book source, it's very easy to say that too is a materialized view on the middle schema. So very little of your integration system changes. In the first way, whenever you add an extra source, you have to redo this. The mediator schema to the mapping becomes, the mapping has to be redone. Okay. So that's one thing that I wanted to bring up in terms of the normal database terminology. And then finally, there is this query processing stuff. I already mentioned it. We will talk a lot about how to do query processing better in the context of databases on the web. But so you should know a little about how it is done in normal databases. And the way it is done in normal databases is you have statistics on the table that are computed overnight, then you use them. Okay? So I'll stop here. Hopefully you'll remember most of it when we take back on Wednesday and start restart. Okay? Yeah, second. Yeah.
I have a small question about the sync nodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the paper you have given homework, can you
just
mm-hmm. points to 53 and 53 points to itself. We had another in this case, don't you think that P3 and P5 become sync nodes? According to what you have said, if they don't have outgoing nodes,
yeah, they are in a sense they are actually sync nodes. In fact, it's even from the point of view of sync node terminology, even any subgraph which has no outgoing nodes could still be a sync node.
Yes.
Okay, suppose I have this, I have this, and I have this, and these guys only point to each other. That's a sync. It's a sync cluster.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So the general definition is that those are also sync, and you know page ranks will get affected by that too. But one useful thing to know is really, although I talked about sync nodes as though they are different from this notion of uniform transition from anybody to anybody else, if you just do the uniform transition, you no longer have sync nodes. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, so there were like two changes. The reason presumably you're asking this is exactly how do I manipulate the page rank matrix such that it would have this. Now, the point is the moment you make every node accessible to every other node, there are no sync nodes left. Although in the class and in some of the published literature, they actually make, in the Google PageRank, they actually make, this is different from that, okay? And in fact, in the paper that is linked from the page, they actually talk about sync nodes, individual sync nodes, and, you know, they add this stuff, okay? But really, theoretically, the moment you did the second part, the first part is no longer needed because there are no sync nodes after that. Now, it's clear that the page rank values would be slightly different if you did both versus if you did just one. But we already talked about how unimportant the actual values of page rank are. All we care about is it's somehow related to some notion of importance. Okay. In fact, even this issue of when we are basically doing uniform transition from every page to every other page, is that a reasonable thing? You know, I mean, we just did that. I mean, you could do something different. For example, as I said, you know, you could do user specific transition, or you could say transition probabilities are much higher to some set of well-known pages in the world, such as CNN.com, Yahoo.com, and much less for the rest. Now, these all will give rise to different, slightly different page ranks. Okay. Theoretically, the only important thing is if the graph is not a periodic and irreducible, then you are not guaranteed to have unique eigenvectors. The moment you did the second thing, which is everybody can go from everybody to everybody else, it's both aperiodic and irreducible. So then it takes care of it.
That's because page rank computation differs because of the z value thing.
I understand, but again, as I'm saying, I mean, there is the issue of the exact answers to specific questions and the issue of what, you know, really what's the theory behind this. And as far as, I mean, I understand that, I mean, normally what people, as I think even Google paper essentially says, a sync node is something which doesn't have any outgoing links, and they do it in a almost a syntactic fashion. You know, they really do it in a syntactic fashion. It's a node from which there are no links coming out. That's it. Not even pointing to itself. There's no links coming out. Okay? And now that normally, you know, what that basically is they just remove all the dangling links from the, you know, if it's pointing to some other pages that are not in the population, they just remove the links. Okay. But if you ask me, is this a, I mean, you know, in terms of the property, you know, if you have a cluster that is disconnected, which only takes stuff in, doesn't give out, you know, it's also a sync node. But page forms work that way. Page form, I mean, when you remove the sync nodes, you didn't completely remove them. What you did was we made sure that theoretically there would be an eigenvector. Okay? But practically, page forms still work. Okay? What happens in page forms is exactly this. There are tons and tons of guys who point to each other, and if, you know, they are very selective in giving out links. They're very selective in giving out links, and that basically, you know, theoretically, you still get eigenvectors because you do have this uniform transition probability to any page in the thing. But practically, it does have an effect. Okay.
Just a, how is the page form different from SEO? What is the
what is
search engine optimization?
What is search engine optimization? I don't know.
I'm not exactly sure. Something which improves your page is that not SEO.
I didn't discuss it in the class.
No, I was just asking.
I don't even know what it is. That's what I'm saying. So if I didn't discuss them, they are different names, but search rank optimization is basically cheating. You know, page forms is one way of cheating. You know, I mean, I don't know that there could be other ways. So for example, you could pay Yahoo to link to you. That will increase your list. You know, that definitely would increase your rank, for example.
Okay. Coming back to this question, I've taken m value. In your answer, you have said m equal to 0, but I've taken some values for this.
Mm-hmm.
So,
the TA should just, I mean, if it's a question of you lost some points,
yeah,
you know, you can tell him to just give you those
I
back.
I think I lost about 6 points.
Yeah, just tell him that you had the conversation with me. And if it's this, then you can tell him, you know, you had a conversation with me and I agreed with your interpretation.
I spoke with Fanbert.
Yeah, I think I saw the mail, but I didn't exactly understand the context. Now I understand. And so it's fine with me if you get those points back. And if that's the reason you lost points, then, you know, yeah. Okay?